I'm longtime journalist and brand new podcaster Meg Heckman, and this is Radio Free Dystopia, a podcast about what we learn when dystopian fiction and current events start to look the same. I'm here with my co-host, Toby Ball, who's a writer of dystopian novels and a panelist on the hit podcast Crime Writers On. Hi, Toby. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Good morning, Meg.
Good morning. I know this is the first time we've recorded this early. How you doing?
We'll see.
Okay. And our guest today is Dr. Robin Hackett. Robin is an associate professor of English and Women's Studies at the University of New Hampshire. Her specialties include literary modernism, Virginia Woolf, feminist theory, queer theory, and LGBTQ literature. So she's really the perfect person to help us start unpacking The Handmaid's Tale. Robin, thank you for coming out.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, really appreciate it. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably know that Hulu has turned Margaret Atwood's 1985 dystopian novel, The Handmaid's Tale, into what's turning out to be a popular and some would say terrifying series that's streaming right now. And today we're going to talk about the first five episodes of the Hulu series. Robin also went above and beyond and watched a movie adaptation that came out in the 90s. We are going to talk about all three of those things today, so spoilers. That said, I think, Robin, you and I can agree that some of the events in the book happened out of sequence in the show.
Oh, yeah.
And so maybe we can try not to spoil any of the plot twists at the tail end of the book.
Okay. I probably won't be able to succeed with that because it's all jumbled in my head.
Okay.
And didn't watch things in order anyway. So
That's all right.
I'll try not to spoil anything for anybody.
That's all right. That's fine. So everybody's been warned. Before we get started, Toby, Robin, what are your initial impressions on the Hulu show?
It's gripping. It's visually stunning. And I don't love being immersed in that kind of horror. It's something vaguely suspect about, I almost wanted to say the pornography of that of horror and pain. And I'm suspect of that.
Yeah.
It reminds me of some of the critique of lynching images.
Yeah.
And where, you know, the reiterating that spectacle is not free from racism and damage. Like reiterating the spectacle of some of the horrors in the Hulu series is not... it's a warning, yes, and it does what dystopian fiction, dystopian material should do, but it also reiterates the logic and the, I don't even know what it is, the terror of those kinds of damage.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Toby, how about you?
Yeah, I think that was interesting, Robin, and I think we'll probably talk about this some more later. You know, I think, again, it's really well done. It's very immersive. I think it's got a sort of unique feel to it. I didn't read the book. I watched the movie, and which came out, I just Googled, in 1990.
Okay.
And, you know, it's hard to, in 2 hours or an hour and a half or however long it was, have the same kind of nuance that you have now. But I do, I think it's really well done, and I'm interested in talking about what the to what end some of the sort of brutality that's shown towards women, and I guess there's two or three sort of specific incidences and what those different incidences mean in the course of the plot, and then also what Margaret Atwood and the screenwriters are trying to sort of get across.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I definitely agree with both of you. I spend a lot of my professional life advocating for women's stories to be told more fully. And so I was excited to see such a big budget adaptation of a book that is very much a woman's story. So from a commercial standpoint and a media ecosystem standpoint, I was excited. But as I sat down to watch it, I had some really mixed feelings. I felt... really voyeuristic. There were parts of it that were incredibly difficult to watch. And at the same time, there were directorial decisions that were amazing. And from a craft standpoint, there was some really great stuff. And from a visual storytelling standpoint, there were some really high-level smart decisions, but I'm left with that question of what does it mean that a story that is very much about state-sponsored rape is making this much money? We got a lot of great letters and emails from listeners. We heard from Cameron, who says he's very impressed so far with the show. He likes the use of music and how expressive Elizabeth Moss is. He thinks that the directors convey a lot without always having to say what's going on. He is, quote, impressed at how much world building they packed in so far, and he's very interested to see how the show will expand on Gilead as a place and a society.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also heard from Lori, who's a high school English teacher who's offering what sounds like a really cool class in the fall. It's going to be all about dystopian literature. She's going to teach The Handmaid's Tale, 1984, and a few other books. And The Handmaid's Tale, she says, is one of her favorite novels, and she's been really impressed with the Hulu series. She says that the imagery and acting have been phenomenal, and she really likes the use of small details, especially the scene between Serena Joy and Offred gardening and cutting dead flowers while discussing the use of Nick as a surrogate for the commander. She said that was one of her favorite directorial decisions. So Robin and Toby, before we kind of get into those deeper questions about what it means that this exists right now as a cultural moment, what do you think of the overall aesthetic and directorial decisions of the show?
It's gorgeous. It's just beautiful. I'm not that sophisticated a critic of movies. I just like to absorb them and get into the magic of the whole scene. But it's gorgeous. It is just beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. How about you, Toby?
I've been kind of struck by the way they sort of balance what we would consider normality now and the sort of unusualness of the actual dystopian setting. So you have what seems like a normal, like super clean and super organized food store, but it's completely populated by sort of handmaids and Marthas walking around in the aisles, and there's no men, of course. And there's some other visuals that are sort of just sort of side things, but I think are very evocative, where they, against the wall, where frequently when they're walking along the river and there's a wall and there are people just hanging there.
Yeah.
I think is, it gives sort of a powerful sort of atmosphere of danger, you know, without having to come right out and say anything. It's like, you know, this not only happens, but they do it in public and then they just leave the bodies there.
Right.
And it's a kind of thing that tyrants do, you know, essentially.
Right. And I mean, you and I have talked before about that dystopian aesthetic, and the light is just eerie. Like the way that they light the sets and the scenes is really amazing. And at the wall, I don't know if you guys remember the scene where, I think it's the first time we see the wall in the show, there are all the flies.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, clearly a familiar geography where something terrible has happened.
And the sound of the flies as well as the mm-hmm. light coming off the flies is incredible.
I mean, that's part of what makes it, I think, more powerful than sort of these sort of space science fiction dystopias where everybody's wearing this, you know, the same outfit and have laser guns and stuff, which is that it's easier to kind of envision this as something that you would experience, because so often dystopias, you know, something like The Hunger Games, for instance,
right.
You know, it's not something, it's hard to place yourself sort of physically into that environment. Whereas with The Handmaid's Tale, you know, besides this sort of social construction mm-hmm. that they've put together, a lot of the details are just things that you're pretty used to.
Also, the details set us in the current moment as well. That all the technology and the
right.
you know, in the cafe, the inability to the fact that her car doesn't have any money, nobody has cash,
right.
And they long after a shop front that used to sell salted caramels, and I don't know how long salted caramels have been a thing, but they're very current, right? And
yep.
So the horror is going on. The people who are experiencing the horror are exactly living where we are living and when we are living right now, with all those little teeny tangible details, like salted caramel, which just places us there so beautifully.
Right, yeah, and Tinder, Uber, the commander has a laptop one morning at breakfast. Mm-hmm. I mean, the at one point I made a list of all of the nods to our time now. You know, you've got the iPhone earbuds, and they're standing outside food trucks when Offred meets Luke. And,
right.
And so it's very modern and very current. And that's made this, I think, more of a cultural moment. And there have been so many examples on social media and in the physical world of people who are upset, mostly with proposed changes to healthcare regulations in the United States. They have been invoking images and phrases from The Handmaid's Tale in protest. And it's been really interesting to watch and see how quickly it's been spreading and influencing the conversation around healthcare.
Time for another fact-filled edition of The News from Dystopia.
Republican leaders in the House and Senate are making good on their campaign promises to overhaul Obamacare, and women's health advocates have a number of concerns about the whole thing. Those concerns include the lack of women involved in the decision-making process and how the bill could make accessing health care more expensive for many people, especially women. But one of the biggest and most publicized complaints about the bill isn't entirely true. And so I am going to take you through what we are going to call the first ever fact-check edition of the News from Dystopia. And it goes like this. On May 4th, New York Magazine published a column with the headline, "In Trump's America, Rape is a Pre-Existing Condition." Lots of people shared that story, and it went quasi-viral on social media. And lots of people used it as a jumping-off point to complain and critique this proposed legislation. But as it turns out, the statement is not entirely true. According to PolitiFact, which is a respected independent fact-checking organization, the proposed healthcare legislation could make healthcare more expensive for people with pre-existing conditions. And that includes pre-existing conditions that stem from sexual assault. So some of the examples that have been given in coverage of this are STDs, trauma, physical injuries, but the rape itself is not a pre-existing condition. So just consider this a healthy reminder that legislation at the federal level is always really complicated, and federal legislation about healthcare is especially complex. And there's still lots of time to have your opinion heard, regardless of how you feel about this and where you are on the political spectrum. There's still a long way to go before any of these proposed changes become law. So if you have an opinion and you care, get involved in the conversation. And just make sure that you are getting your information from a variety of credible sources.
This has been The News from Dystopia. Until next time, stay hopeful.
So, Robin, Toby, what do you think of some of the parallels that we're seeing in our real-life conversation about healthcare and the types of images and stories that we're seeing in The Handmaid's Tale?
Well, one thing that I noticed, which is an indirect response to your question, is that all the healthcare scenes are in these, even when horrific things have been done, like the clitoridectomy, it's immaculate. It's clean. It's regular. They're all white. And so it's visually not a return to the bad old days of back alley healthcare. Mm-hmm. So it's very clearly a forward movement in terms of technology and medical technology and the capacity of medical care. Improved medical care, but it's restricted to certain functions, right? It's restricted to controlling women's bodies.
Right, because like at no point is anybody having a conversation about artificial insemination or other ways that medical technology could assist in conception.
Nor is anybody, you know, getting cared for wounds or diseases,
right,
or things that you imagine are going on around the periphery of medical care in a situation where there's reduced access to resources, including food, right? The grocery stores are pretty spare, and you get with the mm-hmm. coupons, you get the idea that there's a limited access to things that produce health, from food to medical care. And yet the medical scenes themselves suggest high advances, strong advances in medical capabilities and sanitation.
So limited resources are being funneled into controlling women versus liberating.
Now, or, you know, nor do you see any medical care being given to men who are supposedly sterile, right? That's not even discussed, much less, you know, treated in these new fancy healthcare facilities. The only thing you see going on is, you know, checks for fertility and violence.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think that's an interesting point. And the way I kind of took it is that, you know, you have the most modern, in this case, a few years down the road, technology, but it's being used in the service of this philosophy, which the commander talks about in the episode five, which is essentially that, that women are sort of baby vessels, you know, and that, so when you mention artificial insemination, I think the reason why that might not be used is that's not sort of, you know, the quote unquote biblical order of things, which is that, you know, the man sows a seed, the woman carries the baby. So anything outside of that isn't legitimate under this regime. So that's why, you know, you do have this female genital mutilation occurring in this very clinical setting. It's because, you know, it seems, well, like, and this isn't an, this is not an original observation, but fundamentalist religions just across the spectrum are largely concerned with women's sexuality.
Right.
And so that it makes perfect sense within this world where you're trying to control women's sexuality, that when you're having a clitoractomy, that you're doing it in this sort of state-sponsored, very clinical setting. And then, and that's actually, I think, a very, you know, probably important and powerful message that the state is sending.
Yeah, absolutely. And this kind of gets into some of the social capital around the ability to bear children. Robin, is this something that, that you want to help us explore a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the things that I found the show really amplified in a good way, is the way that parenthood is a cultural capital. It's a conditioned value. And a lot of people, of course, choose not to be parents. But even those who do, and who, like, including myself, and, you know, wouldn't trade it for anything, I'm fully aware that my choices are conditioned in this, for, in the natalist period in which we're living post 9/11, as well as, you know, from prior to 9/11. In the Hulu series, that capital, the child as capital, is really made visible, and that capital for some is made possible by the labor of others in a way that operates in our world too. You know, I have two adopted children and I adore them and I am so grateful that, you know, to be their parent. And I'm also aware that the reason I have those children is because someone else couldn't, didn't have the resources to raise them. And so, and that, that, you know, her being obliged to not raise those children has everything to do with economics and race and poverty and generational poverty produced by racism. So, you know, I feel myself in this strange way implicated in this, taking advantage of, for my own, you know, joy, as well as for the, you know, whatever advantages accrue to people for being parents in this culture.
Right.
I have those advantages specifically on the, you know, because someone else did the labor of producing those children and didn't have the resources to keep them.
One of the things I've found kind of interesting about the series has been the commander's wife, whose name I can never quite remember.
Serena Joy.
Serena, yeah. That Serena's attitude towards the situation in which she is in, in that she, you know, she desperately wants a baby.
Right.
And that she seems to have made, like, all these women have sort of, I guess, tried to make their peace with the fact that this is the way it's going to happen, is through this sort of strange surrogacy and these sort of ritualized rapes and then ritualized births and all these kinds of things. But again, what we were just talking about, which is the, you know, the cultural capital of having a child. And in this case, I mean, it's just so clearly false.
That, well, one of the scenes where Serena Joy and Offred are talking makes it clear that there's a crack in Serena Joy's acceptance of the whole thing when she says, you know, what we're doing is so terrible. This is in the scene where they've gone to visit somebody else who's just had a baby.
Right.
I can't remember the names. But Serena Joy acknowledges, what we're doing is so terrible. Terribly difficult, and then some people don't hold up.
Right.
So there's what you're saying is reflected in the series. It's Serena Joy doesn't just seamlessly swallow this idea that what they're doing is biblical.
Right, and then there's kind of the in the series. There's that scene where they're all at the birth, and Offred is walking through the house and the wives offer her a cookie.
Mm.
And it is, you know, the wives see it as this act of compassion, and it really crystallized for me just the power dynamic and how the wives were really infantilizing the handmaids to kind of normalize this weird setup that they're all in.
That scene with the cookie is a great pair with the scene later when the driver, right, who Offred is actually attracted to,
Nick.
Yeah. So you might want the cookie, but when someone else says, this is your job to eat the cookie, and you have to say yes to the cookie, and then, you know, then she spits it out. It's the same thing with I keep wanting to call him Luke.
Yeah, Nick.
Nick,
the driver.
Right, so she's attracted to Nick. She might want to go and sleep with Nick, but when she's told, this is what you'll do, it's like, nah, I don't want that anymore.
Right. Yeah. And then at the end of the fifth episode, there's this whole different take on it.
Yeah.
She's going to see him under her own volition, and it's a completely different depiction of sex than we've seen.
What was your sense? Like, when I was watching it, My initial impression was she's doing this to manipulate him, because now she knows he's an eye, and this is like she realizes that the one thing she has going for her is sex, right? That's literally all she's there for, the only thing she has.
Yeah.
And I interpret it not as like, oh, at last I can like hook up with this guy I'm really into. But instead was, you know, the only way I can exert any control over my situation with this guy who's just like spying on me 24/7 will be to sleep with him. But then when you actually watch the actual scene where it's happening, doesn't really reflect that as much. I mean, it doesn't seem like this sort of cold, calculated thing. It seems like a moment in which she's like, all right, so for, you know, 10 minutes I can live the life the way I want to.
Both of those things are threads picked up from the book, right? Because in the book she says when she is with him, it's so nice to be touched.
Right, yeah.
Right? So there's that element of this is she's doing this for herself.
One of the big differences between the book and the show is the race and ethnicity of many of the characters. And in the book, it is assumed and in some cases implied that only white women are handmaids. And that is clearly not the case. This has a really diverse, really interesting, really talented cast. Does that change something about the narrative to kind of remove that white supremacy element? Robin?
I thought a lot about that because, you know, when in the novel, and if you read the novel with any awareness of eugenics and white supremacy, you know that fertility in fit women, depending on which differs where you are, right? What is categorized or classifies you as fit, white, healthy, middle class, that fertility is prized and other women's fertility is not prized. You get demonized for right. your fertility if you're not in that eugenically fit class. That is a strong piece of the novel. And then when you get to the series, that issue disappears in a way that's distinctly colorblind, right? So that fertility right. in any woman is prized, and it's not spoken about at all. And so it's a colorblind sort of approach to fertility. On the other hand, this falls away a little bit, but especially at the first part of the series, you get the impression that all these dark-skinned bodies have to suffer and die for the central character to have her inner life. And I'm thinking of the child and the husband and the best friend, right? They all circle around our central character, and first off, the husband is shot, the child is traumatized,
right?
The best friend, well, she reappears, but, you know, she's... we don't know what's going to happen to her.
Right, right. And is her arc going to follow the same arc that it does in the book, in which case it's a terrible existence that
exactly.
she ends up in.
It's a tough one. I mean, I think it's fine that they made the decision, and I don't think the show necessarily suffers from it, and mm-hmm. I think there's other outlets to explore, you know, that kind of racism that it doesn't, it's not like it's a topic that's being ignored because it's not addressed in The Handmaid's Tale. And I think, you know, I think women's issues being studied to this level of complexity, I think it's something that's probably rarer. I mean, I'm sure people will push back on this, but my sense is that there have been some high profile mm-hmm. Media looks into racial issues, that something that's just specifically about women and the power dynamics between women and men, and
right.
and the way religious certain religious fundamentalists, I guess, is the best way to talk about it, view women and their role.
Mm-hmm.
I think sort of separating that from some of the other cultural critique probably makes it a more powerful television series.
Yeah, well, and I also, you know, two things on that. One, we're only 5 episodes in, and it's been optioned for a second season. And Atwood's been very involved in the production of this. She is either a producer or an executive producer. And she has said publicly that she is looking forward to exploring and unpacking a lot of the ambiguity that was left at the end of the book in the second season. So I do wonder if we're going to have more space for that, and we're going to explore other themes of oppression in Gilead as the series goes on.
And if there's a season 2 that is more about sort of racial issues, like, that to me would make sense.
Yeah.
But
one of the things that really struck me is how much this is very much coming from a female gaze. And I mean, we see breastfeeding, menstruation, birth, the vulnerability of the female body in this in a way that we don't usually in a lot of pop culture television. So I'm just wondering, you know, Robin, what did you think of that?
I noticed it. In some ways, it's fantastic that it's not remarked mm-hmm. as unusual.
But at the same time, it's complicated, right? Because it's a women's story, and it's exploring kind of many facts of life for a lot of women, but in this really violent, disempowered setting. We touched on this at the beginning of the show. What do we think about this telling of a very female story that includes such a graphic display of violence towards women? How are we squaring that?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, more striking to me while I was watching it is, you know, you have women with blood in their underwear and talking about their bodily functions with these guys who have machine guns, and the guys with machine guns are, you know, taking women into medical clinics, and not the the eyes, the soldiers are not batting an eyelash with being so intimately involved in the control, direct control over women's bodily functions. You know, there's and that was just I noticed that. I'm not sure what to make of it. And I don't know how to answer your question, but that's the part that struck me as I guess something really brilliant about the film, the way that they managed that. And it's such a contrast to the way bodily functions are usually included in films.
Right. Yeah.
Toby, yeah. Well, I think it's, you know, it's the state's sort of profound interest in women's reproduction, you know, so it becomes, I think, part of, you know, representative of the state, whether they're, you know, eyes or guards or whatever, to be intensely aware of, you know, where we are in a particular woman's menstrual cycle. And I think the original point, as I nose butt the microphone, about the violence, you know, I've been thinking about this quite a bit because there is this sort of, is this a feminist show, and can it be feminist when you're seeing all these terrible things happen to women? And I think that's it's a good discussion to have. I mean, the sort of direct analogy is when you see anti-war movies.
Yeah,
they're generally showing the horrors of war, you know, as
that's a really good point.
To try and dissuade you.
So that
showing sort of the to this degree, like if you play out things that seem not innocuous now, but things that are objectionable on sort of a more philosophical thing about how you feel women, what sort of control women should have over health decisions, things like this, and then you just play it out and put it to a point where the state is willing to use violence and coercion in order to enforce these certain values. Like, I think that is, at least in some people's minds, how you make these somewhat less dramatic but no less sort of philosophically important debates that we're having now take on this sort of greater urgency.
Yeah, and, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, we talk about that a lot in journalism. You know, how do you maximize truth telling while still minimizing harm to a vulnerable party? And sometimes for people to care, you have to be really graphic. And it is, you know, there's never a hard and fast answer to exactly where that balance point is. And now I'm wondering, in talking about this with both of you, if that might be kind of the position that the production staff has been in creating this series. You know, how can we be really honest that this is a story built around state-sanctioned rape? This is a society built around the need to rape women in a ceremonial fashion, and be really honest about that without objectifying or overtly or accidentally sexualizing that act.
I think they're doing a brilliant job of being in on that line, and you know, of saying that white supremacy and patriarchy amplified looks like this, and you have to be able to show it to make that point. And they're not the only, I mean, there are other dystopian novels that I could talk about later if you wanted me to, that do a really similar thing in an equally effective way. And just the way we started the conversation is you do some necessary harm. Maybe it's not necessary, but you do some harm as well when you show, for instance, of Glenn being hung.
Right.
They chose very carefully not to show a lot of things that they implied, a lot of rapes that are just implied. I thought they did that brilliantly. It wouldn't be better necessarily to not show of Glenn being hung.
Of Glenn?
Of Glenn. It's not of Glenn, is it? It's the Martha.
Right, yeah.
Yeah,
her,
sorry.
No, you're right. No, her lover, and there's that,
right.
Like, just
horrible,
gut-wrenching van scene,
right,
where, like, it was,
right,
yeah.
You wouldn't have them not show that and not talk about that and suppress that part of the story, but the double-edged sort of showing it is repeating harms.
Right. But they did it from a little bit of a distance. You know, they showed the frame of the Martha being hung. It's framed in the van, and we don't get a close-up of her face. It's still... you know, it's still awful and violent, but it does maybe minimize the impact of that a little bit.
See, it's interesting you say that, because in, like, for me, I think that almost maximizes it, because I think when you show, like, for me, when they show something really up close like that, it's clear to me that I'm watching a movie, because that's not the way you digest it in real life, you know? So when you're showing it from a distance, and I think, again, it's like when they have those people just hanging off the wall, the fact that they're not zooming in and you're saying, like, oh, yeah, this is a movie where this is what you do, but instead you're showing things from a distance, which is how you would see a similar thing happening if you were watching it on TV, say, and they had a clip of it. To me, that seems more like, it seems more real than clearly, you know, a fictional film.
Right.
Not sensationalist.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
There's one change from the first movie to the second that echoes that. The scenes where the ceremony scenes show the face of Offred, you know, sort of in the first movie, she's writhing and miserable and crying. And the second, in the Hulu version, she's just still, right? Her head's just bumping up and down.
Yeah.
And that's much more, seems to me, a much more realistic and effective way to show the horror, right? And less sensationalist.
Right, absolutely.
And her powerlessness in that situation. Yeah. She's a really great actress,
right?
I think. I think there's complexity to the way in which she has to kind of acquiesce into her role and not be rebellious, except in this very limited way in which she might actually be able to get something out of it. And these tiny little things that she does, which in a way reminds me of Winston in 1984, which is you've got this very narrow range in which you can express yourself, and most likely other people will not know it, and you just have to kind of take that for what it's worth. And then, you know, off in the distance, there's this possibility that there's this way of actually accomplishing something with the assistance of some sort of foggy, you know, whether it's May Day or whatever, I can't remember what they call it in 1984, but it's like the resistance or something like that.
Just to jump to another theme that we touched on earlier but did not fully dive into was the use of really modern things in the settings, particularly in the flashbacks. So things we mentioned, Tinder, Uber, earbuds, going into a coffee shop after your morning run for a brioche and a latte. You know, it's very how any one of us might spend a Saturday morning. And it speaks to this idea of incremental moves towards authoritarianism. And we had a really interesting letter from a listener named Deanne. She read the book a few weeks ago. She'd never read it in school, but given all of the publicity around the show, she thought she should pick it up. And she said it was, quote, seriously good and very terrifying given our current climate. It's so crazy to think that rights can be taken away so easily. Then you remind yourself, it's just a book. We'd never let that happen. But who would have thought 20 years ago how many rights we'd willingly give up after 9/11? So I'm wondering, did Toby and Robin, did either of you see similar parallels or have similar thoughts as you were watching the show?
Yeah, I mean, the chilling phrase that one of the characters uses is about after D.C., and that they martial law was declared after D.C. That was a chilling reminder that we have done things and accepted things very recently that... if you want to believe the dystopian vision, right, could lead to this kind of horror.
Right.
There's, if I can speak just briefly about an older book called Swastika Night Catherine Burdekin. It's a dystopian novel that some say was the inspiration to 1984. And it plays out into the future past a Hitler win.
Okay.
And it's a very male supremacist and Aryan view of there's vast tracts of the globe are in this society now, and women are kept in a separate women's quarters, and they have their heads shaved, and they're there for reproduction, and it's a male homoerotic society that so men and boys after a certain age separate themselves off and live in family units, and women are there for to reproduce, and the women have they've become totally abject and groveling. And a few elders have some memory of intellectual lives, but most of the women have become very animalistic.
Okay.
And the leadership is concerned that women have started to not produce girls anymore. They've started to only produce boy babies. And that the leadership is so worried about this that they have a slip, you know, and one of these annual or meetings where all the women have to come and listen to somebody talk, he slips and said, "Be fruitful, bear girls," and there's a gasp from the audience of women who thought that girls and women were abject. And horror that or surprise that anybody would suggest that they bear more of them, but the society has gone so dystopianly masculinist that even the women have started to their bodies don't bear girl children anymore.
So that's called Swastika Knight.
It's called Swastika Knight. It's by Catherine Burdekin, which was a pen name. Her real name was Constantine Murray.
Okay.
Oh no, sorry. That's the other way around. Her real name is Catherine Burdekin, and her pen name was Constantine Murray.
Okay.
I was about to say, if my name was Constantine Murray, I don't think I'd get a pen name.
We'll put a link to that on our website, radiofreedystopia.com, and we will share it on Twitter for our listeners also. Thanks for sharing that.
I think going to your point about incrementalism, I mean, I think I think where it clearly is happening right now is in voting rights for African Americans.
Right.
I mean that's happening while we watch, right? As soon as the Supreme Court struck down the Voting Rights Act and said, you know, there are certain parts of it saying that we don't need to review voting rights practices in these historically discriminatory districts, that instantly the door was opened and you have these efforts to of all different kinds. I mean, there's tons of examples, but it's essentially trying to get African Americans off the voting rolls. We have an attorney general who in some ways made his name in Alabama by intimidating elderly African Americans into not voting.
All right, so we need to start wrapping up our conversation just in the interest of time, but I want to ask a question of both of you based on some statements that members of the cast made before the show was launched. Someone asked if it was a feminist story, and the cast members were hesitant to call it that. If I'm being cynical, I think I know why. It's the same reason why Disney wasn't really clear that the lead in the new Star Wars reboot was going to be a woman. I mean, if I'm feeling really commercial and cynical, that's what I would think. But I don't know if there's more to it. I don't know. So what do you guys think of that?
The only thing I could suppose was in their minds, and again, I didn't hear this said, so it is a guess, was that the film suggests that this is bad for everybody.
Right.
Right. The other none of the men in the Hulu serial are at all happy,
right.
And they're suffering damage, violence, and emotional damage, and I just was guessing that. People might say, well, look, this is about everybody. It's not only about women, so therefore it's not feminist, which is, of course, a total misunderstanding of feminism, which suggests that looking at social problems through a lens of gender and race is the way to do social analysis. And that's what this film does.
Right, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know if they're falling back on the, you know, we lay it out there and then people can draw their own conclusions about what they're looking at. I know that there's been some columns by people who, like, are trying to say that even in this dystopia, there are these certain things that, you know, are you know, show the universal, like, right, like, how wonderful it is to, like, you know, carry a baby to term or whatever. They'll find things that sort of cohere in some way with their, you know, political or social philosophy. And so I guess, you know, maybe that's what it is. It's hard to believe that even if you believe that sort of the kernel that becomes some of these like full blown things in the show, that's where you'd want that kernel to end up being, you know, that would be the manifestation of that value. But I guess that's where it's coming from. I mean, to me, if you were an anti-feminist, I think you would find this show like sort of both immensely frustrating, but also maybe energizing. I mean, it's a very weird, like, it's hard to put myself into a point of view where you would look on this stuff and be like, yeah, you know, that's not so bad. That makes sense.
Right.
But I suppose there are people who would be like, well, that's going a little bit far. But, you know, the basic stuff about the way you place values on women and children and all this stuff, you know, isn't as far out of whack with the way I feel as maybe others.
Right.
That's a conjecture.
And I mean, I think I think it's a fair vein for discussion because that's the point of literature, right? Is to make us think through these things. And, you know, I think it gets back to that tension point we were talking about earlier where the events in the narrative are misogynistic, but the fact that this narrative exists is feminist. And I guess that's kind of how I'm squaring it. And there's a whole lot of gray area in the middle, and that's not bad.
Mm-hmm.
So we are going to end with a letter from Mary. And Mary writes about her first experience reading The Handmaid's Tale. She says that the story, quote, wormed its way into my early 90s high school student brain and gave me a profound jolt. The book shocked my future feminist self into wakefulness and wariness of authority. In simpler words, it was brain changing. So, audience, this letter from Mary is the inspiration for this show's question to you. What brain-changing dystopian books have you read? Why did they rock your world? Let us know, and we may talk about your selections on an upcoming episode. You can find us on Twitter at RFDystopia. You can leave a comment on our website, which is radiofreedystopia.com, or send us an email at radiofreedystopia@gmail.com. We like voice memos too, and we're going to put some instructions on how to send those up on our website very soon. Toby, where can people find you online?
I'm on Twitter at TobyBallNH.
All right. And Robin is not on Twitter, but if you want to hear more from Robin, you should come check out some of her work at the University of New Hampshire. Do you want to tell us a little bit about program offerings here?
Well, I teach in the English department in Women's Studies, and briefly, I can't do it briefly. Go look at the websites and look at classes. There's graduate programs and undergraduate programs as well, and we teach great books, and we teach critical thinking.
Absolutely. And like Robin said, there are programs. I know we have a lot of high school teachers listening to this show, which is great. Tell your friends. We want to hear from more of you. Lots of great programs for working professionals, right?
There's summer programs for teachers in particular who want to learn more and with other people who are teaching literature about how to teach literature in public schools.
Awesome. So we'll put links to that on our website, which is, again, radiofreedystopia.com. All right. Well, Robin, thank you so much for being here today. This was fantastic.
Yes.
We really appreciate your time and your mental energy that you put into this. Thanks for coming out. Radio Free Dystopia is a production of Partners in Crime Media. If you like what you hear, please share with your friends. And this is really important. Leave a review on iTunes. It really, really helps us out. Voice work by Mike Nothnagel. Studio space provided by WUNH. Until next time, this is Radio Free Dystopia.
Partners in Crime Media.
Yay.
All right, we're done.